I'm David Feldman. I'm the director of the Pears Institute for the Study of Antisemitism at Birkbeck. And it's my pleasure to welcome you to the second of this term's a series of webinars for scholars on the theme of the relationship, the often vexed relationship between what we can call anti-Semitism and anti-racism, a relationship which we have addressed and will address both as a matter of politics and also conceptually. In the debates around this theme, our speaker today, Karen Stergner, has a significant voice. These debates in which she and others take part arise in both national and local contexts and are also transnational. Karen is Professor of Sociology at the University of Passau and is the coordinator of the Research Network on Racism and Antisemitism in the European Sociological Association. Her work has focused on critical theory and feminism, as well as on the interrelationship of antisemitism, gender politics, and nationalism. And latterly, she has spoken and written about intersectionality. Today, she will talk on intersectionality and its discontents, why antisemitism matters. I'm sure all of us are extremely eager to hear what she has to say. I'll just ask everyone to ensure that they are muted. And when you, if you have questions, please place them in the chat function. We'll have about half an hour for questions after Karen has spoken, also for about half an hour. So there'll be plenty of time for discussion. So please place your questions in the chat. But right now, it's a great pleasure to introduce our speaker, Karen Stergner, on intersectionality and its discontents.
Hello, everybody. Thank you very much for inviting me to give a presentation at Pears Institute. Of course, I would have preferred to be there in person in London. Maybe I would also get a vaccination there. But so I'm sitting in Vienna and welcome you from Vienna. And yes, the presentation I'm going to give will be about intersectionality and its relation to antisemitism. And this question is relevant, particularly against the background that intersectionality has gained so much influence since the 2000s. So whether antisemitism can be analyzed and criticized using an intersectional framework is not only an academic question, but to a very high degree, also a practical question. Like I would say in general, the research in antisemitism should always be connected to the practical side of combating antisemitism. That's actually the raison d'etre of antisemitism studies. The concept of intersectionality, just to put it shortly, was first formulated by Kimberly Crenshaw in the 1980s as a reaction to the specific situation and experience of Black women in the United States who are exposed to both sexist and racist violence, oppression, and discrimination. From the beginning, intersectionality was intended as a critique of society in its different forms of domination, and intersectionality fostered the perspective of how gender, sexuality, race, ethnicity, and class, how these categories intersect within the broader context of capitalism, patriarchy, and the nation-state order. intersectionality, and this is interesting, criticizes an anti-racism that is blind on the eye of sexism and whose model is the struggle of the Black man. And it also criticizes a feminism that is blind on the eye of racism and whose model is the struggle of the white woman. So I would say that from the beginning, intersectionality has always been both an analytical tool to grasp the complexity of social power relations, as well as a political activism that promoted the interests of marginalized groups. In recent years, intersectionality has experienced an unparalleled upswing and has been applied to a multitude of other cases of discrimination, be it ableism, ageism, regionalism, discrimination on the grounds of religious or political beliefs, and so on. And in this context of an ever-expanding field of intersectional relations, it is indeed striking that global antisemitism is only rarely included in intersectional theory, and that Jews are very often excluded from feminist anti-racist social movements that claim to be guided by intersectionality. The vehement anti-Zionist orientation of some of these movements, be it Women's March on Washington, Chicago Dyke March, or Black Lives Matter, this anti-Zionist orientation poses the question, why does the intersectionality framework routinely exclude the critique of anti-Semitism and the perspective of Jews? So in this presentation, I want to investigate the concept of intersectionality in regard of this particular exclusion. And if we don't want to assume that anti-Semitism itself is the reason for this exclusion, we need to look more closely at the structure of argumentation. I assume that it has very much to do with how racism is theorized and with the very contradictory structure of anti-Semitism itself, which makes that it cannot be grasped so easily within a traditional intersectional framework. So in the next half hour, I will first contrast anti-Semitism and racism. And in a second step, I would like to delineate the reasons for intersectionality excluding anti-Semitism from its analytical frame. Thirdly, and finally, I will go on to develop a specific approach to intersectionality that views ideology in relation to each other and reads anti-Semitism itself as an intersectional ideology. So let me start with the very complex relationship between anti-Semitism and racism. I think that the difficulties in analyzing anti-Semitism within the intersectionality paradigm arise to a large extent from a widespread misunderstanding, namely that anti-Semitism was just a form of racism. In fact, historically as well as nowadays, anti-Semitism has always been a distinctive ideology. It cannot be reduced to racism any more than homophobia can be reduced to sexism. But at the same time, it's more complicated because anti-Semitism is not entirely and utterly different from racism, just as homophobia and sexism are connected ideology. So we will fail to grasp anti-Semitism's complexity if we see it only as a form of racism. But we will not understand it either if we do not also recognize it as a form of racism. It is very important to view anti-Semitism and racism as closely related, though different ideologies. There is, of course, no doubt that anti-Semitism operates with numerous racist elements that moved into the foreground, particularly during the 19th century. Then the traditional religious form of anti-Judaism was replaced by a secular and pseudo-scientific concept of race, with the result that in the eyes of the anti-Semites, Jews were Jews even if they converted to Christianity. This shift became evident particularly in anti-Semitic body images that depicted Jews as weak, sick, filthy, decadent, and ugly, yet inferior to the so-called Aryan body. But they were viewed inferior not because of an assumed closeness to nature, but the other way around. The Jewish body was considered inferior because of a purported lack of nature, and instead a too much of civilization. Thus, racism is unquestionably an important moment for the functioning of anti-Semitism as a modern ideology, but it works differently, and it is not the only moment. Modern anti-Semitism operates substantially on the basis of a distorted perception of capitalist relations of production and their logic of exploitation. Anti-Semitism tries to reduce the complexity of supra-individual social and economic processes and structures by inventing the well-known figures like the greedy Jew, the Jewish banker, or the Jewish conspirator, who can then be held responsible for capitalist exploitation and abstract power relations. This is regularly combined with an anti-intellectualism that fears in Jews a subversive and disintegrating spirit. So, anti-Semitism is essentially about the rejection of spirit and money, this particular combination, spirit and money, expressing a deep unease and discontent in civilization and an inability to understand and properly criticize abstract power relations and their institutions. I think the differences between anti-Semitism and racism are clear. Both colonial and apartheid racism is based on the hierarchical construction of supposedly superior and inferior races. The racial other, constructed as primitive and inferior, represents a lack of civilization and modernity, while racists consider themselves representatives of civilization. Absent in racism are conspiracy myths presuming people of color and colonized people secretly rule the world, control the media and finance, and accelerate the processes of modernization, globalization, and cosmopolitanism. These conspiracy myths are not usually part of racist ideology, but they, however, are an essential feature of anti-Semitism, which suspects an intangible power resides among Jews, one that is ubiquitous and to which anti-Semites do not feel superior, but rather inferior. So in anti-Semitism, Jews are viewed as inferior and superior at once, inferior in their bodies, superior in their spirit and power. These contradictory notions merged into the stereotype of Jewish cunningness and Jewish conspiracy. And these ambiguities add to the difficulties, particularly the left has in understanding how anti-Semitism actually works. Also, many intersectional feminists who stand up against racism seem to share this difficulty. They usually reduce racism to the dichotomy of white and black. And then Jews are implicitly or explicitly identified with whiteness. So Jews can easily be left out of the anti-racist struggle. This is analytically and practically disabling, because anti-Semitism does not run along the color line, and consequently not along the binary divide privileged, non-privileged. Jews are not whites in the sense of what whiteness and the whiteness frame and privilege imply, namely representing the norm and thereby being invisible and safe. The whiteness frame as a tool for making visible structural racism not only proves to be completely unsuitable for an analysis of anti-Semitism, but can even confirm anti-Semitism, as David Schraub has prominently pointed out. The privileges associated with whiteness include power, influence, money, property, education, dominance, participation, being heard and having a voice, cliques and networks, and positions inherited over generations. If this frame is applied to the Jewish minority, it can actually result in the confirmation of anti-Semitic stereotypes, such as the excessive influence of Jews in business, politics, and the media. Jews appear in this frame as the super whites, and global anti-Semitism can thus be excluded from the anti-racist intersectional analysis and practices. That Jews are hardly recognized as a minority that has been racially persecuted and murdered for centuries is basically due to this double reduction going on. Firstly, anti-Semitism is being reduced to a mere form of racism, and secondly, racism is being reduced to the color line. As a result, anti-Semitism does not appear anymore because it doesn't fit in. As Robert Fine prominently pointed out, a musealization of anti-Semitism is going on. Only the super-racist and exterminatory forms of National Socialist past are being recognized, while current forms of anti-Semitism do not in the first place operate on a traditionally racist level regularly go unrecognized. In fact, while anti-Semitism and racism are historically closely related, they have developed in different directions after the Shoah and in post-colonial contexts. But even today, it becomes evident that anti-Semitism is also a form of racism. As Daniel Bedil, in his recent work, Jews Don't Count, shows clearly by means of a lot of examples. Jews suffer from discrimination, harassment, and hatred, which would rightfully be considered racist if they were directed against ethnic minorities other than Jews. But particularly within parts of the left, contemporary anti-Semitism no longer primarily operates as a racism, but has changed into post-national forms in which Israel is utilized as a universal scapegoat for wars and crises worldwide. It may even take on anti-national forms and may be wrapped into the ideology of anti-Zionism as a wrong and distorted critique of nationalism, comparable to the completely delusional and distorted critique of capitalism. Such forms of anti-Zionism do not recognize Israel as a refuge for Jews worldwide after the Shoah, but instead see the Jewish state as uniquely inauthentic and artificial, while all other states, particularly the Arab ones in the region, are viewed as natural. In these cases, the discrimination against Jews is different from that of people of color and can even be regarded as oppositional, since the alleged intention might be an anti-imperialist one. I think it is decisive to recognize this difference between contemporary Israel-related forms of anti-Semitism and racism, and still to see the connection between anti-Semitism and racism, because also an anti-Semitism related to Israel is not just a political opinion that might be expressed within the framework of freedom of expression. It is not just a form of criticism toward Israeli government and politics, but goes far beyond that. In denying Israel the right to exist as a Jewish nation state, it may in fact turn into a contemporary expression of the will to erase Jews from the face of the earth. In that sense, it is directly related to National Socialism and thus utterly racist. After the Shoah and the experience that the world did nothing against it, nobody can behave as if it never had happened. I think it is necessary to name it that clearly in order to counter those attempts which mask this form of anti-Semitism even as anti-racist and oppositional. Thus, to sum up this part, it is wrong to conflate anti-Semitism with racism, but it is also wrong to exaggerate the disconnection of racism and anti-Semitism. With critical theory, it is all about mediation, to see the continuity within the discontinuity. But what does this all have to do with intersectionality? I come to my second point, why intersectionality often excludes the analysis of anti-Semitism. Intersectionality usually uses the framework of race, class, and gender for analyzing in what ways members of minorities are affected by discrimination, domination, violence, hatred, and exploitation. We have seen that Jews and anti-Semitism cannot be sufficiently grasped with the analytical tools of critical race studies, particularly the whiteness frame. Anti-Semitism is a specific and very ambiguous ideology that pushes the Jews beyond the stable categories of intersectionality. So not only in regard of the race category are Jews not assignable, but also with regard to the other categories that are central to the intersectionality frame, namely gender and class. And I would like to elaborate a little on this ambiguous character of anti-Semitism. Our societies are organized along clear binary markers, such as belonging, not belonging, privileged, unprivileged, white, black, male, female, hetero, lesbian, slash gay, and so on. And these markers are repressively assigned to individuals in racism, sexism, homophobia, nationalism, and ethnocentrism. So these ideologies position people of color, women, gays and lesbians, foreigners and strangers, more or less unambiguously along the binary codes, usually on the less powerful side. Antisemitism, by contrast, is characterized by ambivalence with regard to these markers. Antisemitism does not position Jews unambiguously on one or the other side of this binary, but rather attributes to Jews a position beyond binary categorization. The history of antisemitism shows that Jews are regarded as unclassifiable in the three dimensions that are central to the classical intersectionality approach: gender, sexuality, class, and race, ethnicity, nation. So we saw already that the race category does not fit, but also the gender category. Countless are the images, especially in the late 19th and early 20th century, which ascribed an ambiguous gender and sexuality to Jews. Antisemitism traditionally considered Jewish men to be effeminate, Jewish women to be masculinized. They were said to blur the clearly drawn boundaries between the genders, to dissolve gender identity, to reverse gender roles and the gender-specific division of labor. Consequently, women's emancipation was also interpreted as a Jewish machination against the unity of the people. Jews were attributed an intermediate position regarding gender and sexuality. And so they were also seen as an essential threat to the unity of the cultural community, because this cultural community then and also today is inseparably linked to the heteronormative order of gender. And finally, the category of class is also not distinctive with regard to Jews. One major characteristic of antisemitism's classical inventory is that Jews are identified with the intermediary economic sphere of circulation, meaning with trade, banking, and money transactions. And so they are primarily seen as speculators and financial capitalists. This in turn announces the ideological division of the capital relationship into productive and rapacious, one of the ideological bases of National Socialism. The position of the trader that is associated with the Jews, this position is an intermediate one that makes the class position appear ambiguous and vague. Jews were neither masters nor servants. If they attributed themselves to the class of the bourgeois, they encountered the cliché of the misfit bourgeois, as Adorno famously found out in The Authoritarian Personality, the misfit bourgeois meaning that Jews would only imitate the capitalist business while lacking any feeling for real and sincere entrepreneurship, and therefore representing the negative effects of capitalism in its purest form. As the voice of the working class, in turn, they were seen as hypocrites speaking from a position alienated from all physical labor about things they knew nothing about. So we see that also here, Jews in antisemitism are not assigned to a clear class position. Antisemitism is a particular fear that the unity and identity of the nation, of the religion, of the community, and so on, might be infiltrated and decomposed. Conspiracy myths are a manifestation of this fear. In this context, Jews do not represent a foreign or hostile identity, but rather an anti-identity, meaning the dissolvent of fixed boundaries of collective cultural identities as such. Here, another difference to newer forms of racism, like cultural racism or racism without races, becomes clear. For example, anti-Muslim racism ascribes to Muslims a hermetically sealed and fixed identity, and the anti-Muslim racists may even envy Muslims for this ascribed hermetically sealed and fixed identity. In anti-Semitism, by contrast, Jews are characterized as lacking identity or roots altogether. And this is already can already be seen in National Socialism. The National Socialist mania saw Jews not as an alien race that was to be subjugated and exploited, but as an anti-race, the negative principle as such, on whose extermination the salvation of the world was to depend, as Horkheimer and Adorno famously analyzed in the Dialectic of Enlightenment. The mania of redemption through exterminatory anti-Semitism of the Nazis emerged from a view of Jews as settled in a non-place beyond the authoritative categorical order of the world. So Jews were seen as a threat to this authoritative categorical order of the world. And this is a quasi anti-categorical character of anti-Semitism. And due to this anti-categorical character of anti-Semitism, it can hardly be grasped by dominant intersectional approaches, because these dominant approaches assume the interdependence of stable categories. Anti-Semitism denies Jews any clear categorization and derives its effectiveness and efficiency from an almost queer thwarting of familiar binaries and from undermining clear categorizations. Jews are not assignable to race, class, or gender, because anti-Semitism itself blurs these categories and portrays the Jews as not belonging to any identity criteria. These analytic difficulties of grasping anti-Semitism seem to translate into growing political abuse of the concept of intersectionality in numerous feminist and anti-racist movements. For example, in the political practice of certain queer and feminist activists, the so-called Queer International, Israelis Omas are considered to be on the privileged side of global power relations, and so anti-Semitism is no longer perceived as a concrete danger. What intersectional activists are otherwise advocating elsewhere, namely women's and LGBTIQ rights, is turned against Israel and seen as a unique depravity in the form of pinkwashing and homo-nationalism. Queer, anti-racist, and feminist initiatives such as Women's March on Washington, Chicago Dyke March, or Black Lives Matter routinely exclude Jews and the Jewish experience with global anti-Semitism. For example, Linda Sarsour, the former organizer of the Women's March on Washington, famously stated that Zionism and feminism would exclude and contradict each other. This is just to name a few examples. So in face of these difficulties in the relationship between intersectionality and anti-Semitism, some completely reject the concept. But I'm convinced that this is the wrong way. And with this, I come to my third and last point, how to prevent that intersectionality turns against Jews. I myself have often experienced that a strict rejection of intersectionality, even if it is very well argued, brings little sympathy and does not encourage young people to think independently and autonomously. The reactions tend to be very defensive. The concept is too popular and too much linked to global feminist and anti-racist struggle and resistance. So I think it's much better to address the diversity of intersectional approaches and to show that the narrowness that leads to anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism is not necessary, yet even contradicts intersectional thinking. because intersectionality actually is about bringing together elements and perspectives that are ideologically fragmented and torn apart, but which are actually related. In fact, it contradicts intersectionality as a broader frame of viewing society as a totality when perspectives are narrowed down to mere identity politics and hierarchies of victimhood and struggles. In order to prevent this, I argue for a critical reclaiming of the approach. Suitably reformed, I believe the concept can strengthen our analysis of contemporary societies and be particularly fruitful for ideology critique. My motivation to take antisemitism as a starting point for intersectionality lies precisely in the characteristics of antisemitism itself. As demonstrated, Jews do not easily fit into the categories with which intersectionality mainly operates. However, antisemitism itself unites all these categories and is thus a prime example of intersectionality. As a comprehensive ideology, indeed as a worldview, antisemitism operates with sexist, homophobic, racist, ethnocentric, nationalist, and anti-nationalist moments. Furthermore, antisemitism reflects the global economic class relationship and the nation-state order in a completely and pathologically distorted way and masks itself as a critique of capitalism and imperialism. It thus becomes clear that on the ideological level, racism and nationalism, sexism and homophobia, as well as the ideological distorted view of class society, are united in modern antisemitism. Thus, the intersectional categories, race, class, and gender, appear in antisemitism. And antisemitism, I would therefore define as the intersectional ideology par excellence. I have developed the concept of intersectionality of ideologies in order to grasp this. What I do not mean with this is that ideologies are interchangeable or should be equated. Rather, I believe we can distinguish between ideologies while understanding that they gain their respective specificity precisely from their interaction with one another. Ideologies are best understood as being interdependent. They not only usually appear in a bundle, but each ideology also carries moments of the other ideologies within themselves, and they thus merge together. And from this perspective, the close relationship between antisemitism, racism, sexism, homophobia, nationalism, and ethnocentrism becomes evident. And I think that we need to constantly point to these ideological intersections in order to prevent the current trend towards fragmentation and repressive particularism, a particularism which Viviane Teitelbaum called the identity house arrest. We need to open up the perspective again and view intersectionality as what it can also be, a framework to analyze the big relationships that constitute our society, a narrative to understand the need for a universality that breaks through the narrowness of selected empathy and restrictive identity politics. An intersectional analysis of ideologies may also advance the practice of coalition building so that the struggle against antisemitism can no longer be seen as opposed to anti-racism or even as racist itself. A lot of work rests to be done in this respect, but I'm sure it is worthwhile. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Karen, for a talk that was as clear as it was challenging, by which I mean it was both very clear and very challenging. I'll just ask people, I can see that there's already a question in the chat, and please, others, place your questions there, and I'll get through as many as I can. Karen, can I just start off by asking you, in a sense, it's a question that takes off from where you ended up, which is with your attempt reclaiming the concept of intersectionality, which might suggest that the problems that you were discussing in the bulk of your talk are not necessarily inherent to the concept of intersectionality itself, but rather need to be located on the left, in politics rather than in theory. And I was thinking, for example, that your some of your comments on the ways in which intersectionality as it's practiced can't deal with ambivalence, in some ways echoed Zygmunt Bauman's writing on that theme. And certainly feminist anti-Zionism, as I think you said yourself, considerably predated intersectionality. So I suppose my question is, does the concept of intersectionality itself present a problem, or is it more the way in which it has been used by actors who are political actors as well as academic actors in a particular political context?
Oh, thank you very much, David, for this question. I think that we cannot talk about the intersectionality concept per se. And this is what I try to explain during my talk, because I think that intersectionality is just like other concepts, is always in the making. It's always like a performative act, maybe like this. So it's always the way how it is used. It's always the way how it is expressed. It's always the way how it is used, be it in discourse, be it in academic discourse, be it in political praxis. So I also don't want to say that intersectionality is just an empty shell in which you can put like everything into it, because it's just, you know, it's just a concept. And as a concept, it's quite patient because you can do whatever with it, whatever you want with it. No, this not either. But I think intersectionality in its very beginning has been developed, no, I'm sure it has been developed, to describe a very particular problem situation. And this problem situation was the tremendous racism in the USA against Black people. And then it was also seen that Black women not only suffer from racism, but they also suffer from sexism and from gender discrimination, from sexual discrimination, and so on. And then this particular form of intersectional critique emerged, but it was still connected very closely to that particular problem situation in the United States. And it had not in the first place to do with an analysis or with a critique of anti-Semitism. And this is why I was starting my my talk with contrasting anti-Semitism and racism, because they are very closely connected, but they are not the same. And this is the reason why we need to adapt the intersectionality concept in order to be able to grasp anti-Semitism with it, and in order to start our analysis with anti-Semitism. But I think the concept itself, the intersectionality concept itself, gives us the possibility and the opportunity to do so, to open it up. And when I said that the initial problem situation from which intersectionality started was racism and the connected sexism in the USA, this does not necessarily mean that it's against the Jews. So this is exact. This is a political decision that people are making, and it's not inscribed into the concept of intersectionality.
Thank you, Karen. There are a number of questions. I'm going to give you two at the same time, because as you'll see, they are interconnected. The first is from Ezra Ozurek, who thanks you for the talk, agrees that it's important to underline the specificities of anti-Semitism, but asks, would you not agree that anti-Black racism, anti-Muslim racism, anti-race, Asian racism also have their specificities? They're all marked by hatred and fear of these people, seeing them as inferior and embodying special powers. Also that, like other racism, some characteristics of anti-Semitism change through time as some stay the same. What do we gain and what do we lose by setting anti-Semitism as categorically different? Does this approach not contribute to the exclusion of anti-Semitism from discussions of racism? And a question from Nancy Al-Hachem is related in some ways. She asks, isn't keeping the word anti-Semitism a perpetuation of its ambiguous element, instead of clearly pointing that it is against Jews, anti-Judaism, and Judeophobic? And also this siding of anti-Semitism, perhaps it means this separation of racism and anti-Semitism, doesn't it establish a hierarchy and provoke competition, which is the connection with Ezra's question, perhaps? Isn't it better to fight and acknowledge that they both start with othering?
Yes, thank you very much for these questions. I think we are really at the core of the problem here, because we see that both, if we simply see anti-Semitism as a form of racism, we have seen that it is blinded out from the particular frame of analysis. Why? Because currently, racism is more often than not reduced to the color line. So, and if we see racism just as this form of racism, then anti-Semitism necessarily is blinded out. If we broaden the view of racism, and if we take into account also other forms of racism, then it works better. But still, there are major differences, and these major differences are particularly the ambivalences that I wanted to make clear, that I wanted to highlight. And of course, no ideology is unambivalent at all. Why? Because it's not about the people who are targeted. It's always about the racists. It's always about the sexists and so on. So a very high proportion of these ideologies is actually the state of mind of the racists themselves. And they are, of course, ambiguous. So there is also ambiguity in racism. But I think we have to distinguish here quantity and quality, because anti-Semitism is so much more ambiguous that it also changes the feature, that it changes the character, so that eventually something completely different may come out when the ambiguity is so exaggerated as it is in anti-Semitism. And one major point, really at the center of modern anti-Semitic prejudice and ideology, is the conspiracy myth. And this is preponderant in any form of anti-Semitism. And you would not find that to that extent in racism, in any form of racism. I mean, the ambiguity and this conspiracy is again connected to the ambiguity that Jews are on the one hand identified with a lack of nature, and on the other hand identified with a superpower, as a hidden superpower, because of their lack of nature and because of their too much of civilization. You would not see that in any sort of racism. I mean, to put it short, the conspiracy that Africans would secretly rule the world, the media, the financial markets, and so on, is simply not part of racist ideology. And that Muslims would not have a very fixed identity is simply not part of anti-Muslim racism, but it is part, a central part of anti-Semitism. So I think we need, what we really need to do in order to, in order not to trap into, going into this trap that is described in the, mentioned in the questions, we need to keep the mediation. We need to think where are the similarities, but where are also the differences, and not to drift into either this direction or the other direction, because I think it's really important to keep it apart and still see the connection between the two. And yeah.
Thank you, Karen. We have a comment from Jack Gilbert, who endorses entirely your revised model of intersectionality. He says it's clear that in many contexts, Jews who are also LGBTQ+ or women or BAME find themselves excluded from the model. Equally, the intersectional diversity within currently hermetically sealed identities and communities need to be included too. We have a question on which takes a different tack from Sandra Lipner, who asks, to what extent do you think it would be appropriate to employ an intersectional lens for the study of middle-class German Jews in the Nazi state, who were privileged to some extent, even as they were persecuted? I have to say, I'm not sure that middle-class German, there are middle-class German Jews in Nazi Germany, but not in the Nazi state, I think. Karen.
Yes, I don't think that we can talk about any state of being privileged as a Jew in Nazi Germany, come on. I mean, this doesn't make sense at all. If I understood that correctly, that question, because I mean, even economically advanced Jews in the Nazi state were robbed, were taken to concentration camps, were gassed if they weren't lucky and could go into exile. So where's the privilege? I don't get the question.
I completely endorse that answer, Karen. We have a question from Assam Ashenden, who asks, isn't the problem with intersectionality itself, which suggests an additive approach to sociological analysis, i.e. it is not theory or conceptual development. At best, it names a problem for sociology that is then picked up for political practice, but does not make it more productive.
Yes, I think that this is already a description of a particular usage of intersectionality, because intersectionality itself, if I may use that term itself, is not restricted, is not an additive approach, but rather looks at how the one is in the other. I mean, this was Kimberly Crenshaw's approach to analyze how sexism and racism intersect and how the experience, the particular experience of Black women in the USA could not be like reduced to a racism or to a sexism, and then we add the two together and then we've got the black woman, we've got the situation of the Black woman. No, and this also shows in, for example, in interviews with Jewish women, when asked, for their experiences with sexism and anti-Semitism. They usually tell stories where both experiences are intermingled and you cannot possibly divide the one from the other, and you cannot possibly say, strictly say, what part of this experience of discrimination, of hatred, of violence, and so on is anti-Semitic and which one is sexist. So intersectionality actually does not just add the one to the other, but actually tries to go beyond this this adding up. And I think what is described here in this question is rather how restrictive identity politics would make use of the concept in saying, so here we've got three discriminatory categories coming together, there we've got four, and here we've got five, and here we've got only one. So we've got a clear hierarchy of who is most discriminated against, who is the biggest victim in world history, and so on. But I don't think that this is fruitful, of course not, but I don't think that this is actually has so very much to do with what intersectionality could mean and what and how it was conceptualized in the beginning.
Thank you, Karen. Rachel Garfield asks if you would, I think, place what you had to say today in the context of work by Wendy Brown on the relationship between feminism and Jewishness, or what she has to say about debates on tolerance and equality. Is that a question which is which is helpful for you, Karen? Or,
well, it is a very interesting question, but I think it's way too broad a question to be answered here. And actually, the relationship between feminism and Jewishness is a completely different area compared to the area that I tried to touch upon here, because I wasn't touching on Jewishness and feminism, but on feminism and anti-Semitism. So this is a completely different area.
And we have a question from Joseph Finlay, who says that you suggested that conspiracy theories are unique to anti-Semitism as opposed to other forms of racism, but surely contemporary Islamophobia is marked out by a high degree of conspiracy, suggesting that Muslims are a hostile force planning to take control of society. Would you say that this kind of Islamophobia is a subset of anti-Semitism?
No, I wouldn't. I would also clearly distinguish between anti-Muslim racism and anti-Semitism. And I agree that there is, of course, there's very much a pending doom seen in anti-Muslim racism, that Muslims would actually destroy the Western culture, that they would destroy our national identity and whatsoever. But this is part of any racism. So you would have this also with anti-Black racism, you would have this with xenophobia, and so on. So I don't think that this is so very different. What you don't have actually in anti-Muslim racism is that Muslims secretly guide the world, that they would secretly so one example, what is called in the extreme right, the big replacement, that Muslims, refugees, immigrants, and so on would flood into Europe and would destroy European identity or national identities, and so on. So this is the threat that is seen for coming from Muslims. But behind the scenes, even these so-called immigration floods are, in their view, guided by Jews. So, and this is what I mean with conspiracy myth, that you can't even see what they are doing purportedly. This is conspiracy. It's not that people are blamed of destroying a national identity, because this is a major part of xenophobia end of racism. But anti-Semitism adds this particular detail of seeing Jews acting behind the scenes. And you wouldn't have that with Muslims.
And we have a couple of, I think these will have to be our last questions, but they're sort of interesting questions. In a sense, they follow on, in one sense, from Rachel's question about Wendy Brown earlier, because they indicate the way in which your talk has made people think about your argument in relation to other people's arguments, which they are familiar with. So Yulia Egorova asks, would you say that Michael Rothberg's multidirectionality framework provides a useful analytical tool for theorizing minority experiences in a comparative perspective? And maybe this one as well. If you don't know the work, you don't know the work. Eric Ward's analysis, Sharon Vance asks, are you familiar with Eric Ward's analysis of white nationalist ideology that sees anti-Semitism as central to white nationalist racism, which claims Jews are the masterminds of civil rights and responsible for dismantling white supremacy in the US?
Well, I don't know his analysis, but what is written here in this question sounds quite plausible to me.
And then that means we are able to take one very last question from Jackie Batisha. How would you analyze the intersection of trans and radical feminist realities? Which
has nothing to do with anti-Semitism in the first
place.
So the relationship between radical feminists and trans feminists, so radical feminists, those who would deny trans women the right to be women, or is this the question? Probably. I would say that if radical feminists are denying trans women the right to be women, this is not legitimate. I mean, I don't support views on gender that are so biologized. This is exactly what, and this is what I find so interesting, and you may forgive me to say that, but I find it really interesting to have in the anti-Semitic stereotypes, and I tried to figure that out a little bit in my talk. You've got in the anti-Semitic stereotypes, in the all that stereotypy, you've got a negativity, a particular negativity, namely the negativity that points beyond categorization. But this beyond of categorization that is actually longed for in queer theory, in feminism, that is not that sort of radical feminism and trans feminism and so on. So you've got a longing for a beyond the categorization, to get rid of those categories. And you've got this negatively already in anti-Semitism, but in a very, very, very distorted way, in a cruel way, in an exclusionary way, so that it is actually shown to those people who are prejudiced that a beyond of categories is actually a threat, is something that is against our way of life, against our culture, against our everything, against us. So, and this is what I really find interesting in anti-Semitism, that we can, that even in this, from this anti-Semitism, we can take something out in the negativity and say, okay, this is what they are actually against. And this is what they see in the Jews, the threat that there might not be nature in the way they see nature, that nature might be something that is just made by society, and that is that can be, so that change is possible. And I think this is all anti-Semitism is about, and sexism is about, and racism is about, to keep society the way it is, and not to change it in a progressive way. And this is why progressivism is prominently projected into the figure, diverse figures of Jews. They are the progressives, and they are whom we need to be afraid of.
Well, thank you, Karen, ever so much. We're going to have to draw things to a close in a moment, but before doing so, I'd like to thank you, not least for your extremely thoughtful and generous answers to the excellent questions that you received, but even more, I think, for dealing with complex and extremely difficult issues, conceptually difficult and also politically difficult issues, with such great clarity of thought and presentation. I'm really extremely grateful. I'm sure we all are too. I'll ask those who are here if they can unmute and give you a round of applause before the session will end. Thank you very much, Karen.
That's very nice. Thank you so much. I enjoyed very much to be with you in this webinar series, and thank you very much for listening to my talk, and thank you very much for listening also to my answers to your questions. And I'm very much looking forward to hopefully seeing some of you in presence in one or the other event to come after this horrible pandemic. I wish you all the best. And